Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. As today, we talk about the management of multiple myeloma with Dr. Saji Kumar from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. We have a great faculty for this program, and later on, we'll show you the results of a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to have us discuss, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As always, I have a very brief 1 minute pre-meeting and post-meeting survey. If you could please take that, I think you'll get a lot more out of this and we'll learn a little bit more about you. We know a lot of people end up listening to these webinars, and if you're into audio programs while you're working out or on the beach or whatever, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Krishnan on BCMA-directed therapies. Well, this is the last webinar of the year. I feel kind of sentimental now. It's been 2.5 years. I can't believe people are still coming. We're even seeing more people join us. It's been what an experience for us. We're going to pick it back up in the beginning of the year. We'll start out with breast cancer. We just came back from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting. So January 4th, we'll talk with Dr. O'Shaughnessy and Dr. Schmidt about what's happened in the past year. And then on the next day, we'll be talking about CLL with Drs. Brown and Stevens. And then we'll also be doing a year review program on myeloma in the beginning of January, January 10th as well, reviewing ASH and everything else that happened last year. And then we'll be reviewing targeted therapy in our year in review series of Dr. Piotrowska and Dr. Riley. Then we'll be heading out to the GI Cancer Symposium in San Francisco. We'll be doing 3 satellites there on colon cancer, upper GI cancers, and about a biliary cancers. This will also be online, so check it out if you're not going to be in San Francisco. And then we'll continue our year in review series on gynecologic oncology, PARP inhibitors, et cetera. But today we're here to talk about multiple myeloma, so much going on in oncology in general, but particularly myeloma. And as always, we're going to bring in a bunch of real-world scenarios. We have docs in practice and a couple of academic institutions who've got some cases and questions for Dr. Kumar, and we'll spend quite a bit of time doing that. First, we're going to chat about a couple of recent issues, then we'll go through the cases, and then hopefully have enough time to go through a few of the papers that Dr. Kumar has been involved with. So, Saji, of course, we just saw the approval of the first bispecific teclistamab. To me, this is like a new era of oncology. So many questions from oncologists. We know ASH was full of papers on bispecifics. We'll talk about that in a second. But I'm curious, and this is one of the many papers you've done talking about kind of where we are and where we're heading in myeloma. I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of how you see the next few years. In addition to immunotherapy, what other developments do you think are going to be coming into practice?
Yeah, I know, as you rightly said, the immunotherapy has taken the center place for myeloma therapeutics and recent advances. And clearly, you know, we are seeing unprecedented response rates in very advanced disease with the immunotherapies, particularly CAR-T and bispecific antibodies. Now, of course, I think the field is going to move in two major directions. One, of course, is going to be trying to maximize the use of these immunotherapies by moving them closer and closer to that initial diagnosis, but also in case of bispecifics, potentially starting to look at combination studies. Alongside, I think there are several, you know, important small molecules that are moving ahead. I think they're going to play an important role. We have been using venetoclax for some time off-label, but hopefully we'll hear some results from the phase 3 trial coming up here soon. Clearly, we have exciting new molecules, particularly the CELMoDs, which appears to be more potent than the existing IMiDs and could replace some of them, depending on the results of the trials that are either ongoing or planned. And we also have some interesting new molecules, including, monoclonal antibodies targeting CD38, which also carries interferon with it, as we saw at the ASH meeting, and also somoelation inhibitors that are in clinical trials. So a variety of different novel or new-to-myeloma classes of therapies that are also being explored.
I'm kind of curious that I tend to see things from a macro perspective, like, you know, a lot of general medical oncologists see things. And as I look back over the last 10, 15 years of myeloma, first I saw, you know, triple therapy coming in, RVD. That was a, you know, seemed like a big change. And then the anti-CD38s coming in, particularly daratumumab. I'm curious how you would compare what you think is going to be the impact of CAR-T and bispecifics immunotherapy compared to, say, anti-CD38. Do you think that the overall impact is going to be as great as anti-CD38 or maybe even greater?
I'm thinking it's going to be actually even greater than what we saw with the anti-CD38 monoclonal antibodies. Because if you look at even the anti-CD38 when they came in, you know, just by itself, we were looking at response rates maybe more like the traditional 30-40%. And here now we are talking about CAR-T, which is giving you almost 100% response rate in bispecifics at 70% plus across the board. So clearly, you know, agent to agent, this appears to be quite effective in late stage diseases. Now, I think the key thing is going to be, you know, the advantage of a new therapy is not just going to be the response rate dependent. It's also going to depend on, you know, how durable the responses are, how long can patients stay on it, and what are the resistance mechanisms that might evolve over time. So I think what we are going to see is, you know, moving these agents to the upfront setting where the impact might be, you know, magnified to some extent, especially if you can, you know, use approaches like CAR-T therapy in a subgroup of patients in newly diagnosed myeloma, you know, for example, a high-risk patients, right, where we are looking at a PFS of 1 or 2 years right now, and given CAR-T, can we take that to maybe 4 or 5 years, which would be a dramatic improvement for the high-risk patients and get them maybe at, you know, get to parity with what's happening with the standard risk people at this point. So I think it's all going to boil down to where are we going to use it and what is the long-term impact of that downstream.
Do you see us moving towards an era of MRD-directed therapy? Do you think in clinical practice over the next 5 years, docs in the community are going to be actively using MRD to decide on treatment?
I think we are certainly moving in that direction. There's certain uncertainties, I think, in terms of is it just one-time MRD negativity? Do we need two? Do they need to be 6 months apart, a year apart before we say it's good enough for us to act upon it? So there are some questions that are unanswered. But in terms of, you know, I am really hoping, and I think it will happen, is that the MRD testing will allow us to move from that paradigm of continuous non-stop therapy to limited duration treatment that is more response adapted. It may not be true for everybody. We might still continue to treat high-risk myeloma continuously. But at least for a major subgroup of patients with more indolent disease, I am hoping that we can give them treatment-free intervals by utilizing resources like or tests like MRD testing.
So the other thing I want to ask you about before we start making rounds on these patients, of course, a few weeks ago, when we did this program with Dr. Richardson, I think it was like the day after belantamab had been removed from the market. And of course, you know, we have cases we've been presenting. We first saw this press release in the beginning of November that the trial comparing it to pomalidomide with low-dose dex wasn't superior. And then I guess with the FDA's encouragement, the drug was removed from the market. I guess we'll sort of see where things head in the future. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, I don't envy the FDA at all. I mean, like trying to, in oncology in particular, it's like trying to study the Talmud, I mean. But I, you know, and I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are about this. We see that this is the trial that, you know, was negative compared to Pom-Dex, but there are also a couple other randomized trials that are accrued and maybe, I guess, theoretically will be presented over the next year. Any thoughts about where you see it, whether there is a future for belantamab? It's hard to believe. We presented a case about a month ago of a patient who had been on it for 4 years. It has a 41% response rate. It's hard to imagine that we wouldn't have it available, but any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think it certainly was disappointing, the results of the DREAM-3 trial, and certainly the fact the drug was removed from the market was also disappointing in that, you know, it's a treatment option that is being taken away. I think the drug, you know, has promise, and hopefully some of those phase 3 trials will demonstrate positive results and will allow the drug to become available again. I mean, we have clearly seen patients, as you just mentioned, who have had very prolonged responses on belantamab. You know, it certainly goes after a target. We know it is quite valid. We know it can produce responses in about at least a third of the patients or more. And these responses sometimes can be quite long-lasting despite, you know, not having to give repeated dosing. I think the biggest problem we have seen with that drug is obviously the ocular toxicity. And hopefully as we learn more about this, you know, we are able to dose it less frequently and to avoid the eye toxicity. And, you know, that kind of a less frequent dosing, I think, is going to be more beneficial in a setting where it's being used in combination, like either the pomalidomide or the bortezomib combination, which was studied in the phase 3 trials. So I think we'll keep our fingers crossed, see what comes out, but I think there's still promise there.
So I'm still trying to figure the whole thing out, but I'll tell you that earlier today I was doing a session with, I don't know if you know Greg Riley, he's a lung cancer doc at a Memorial, and he was going over a drug called adagrasib used in KRAS G12C. There's also sotorasib that's already been approved. Adagrasib just got approved. Single agent data, no randomized data, no survival data, and there's another drug available and it got approved. So I'm not criticizing the FDA. I was just trying to understand, right. You know, kind of what they're doing. I guess to
sometimes
be continued.
Right. I think part of it is just the whole tenet, the principle of accelerated approval. I think the paradigm is that if you give accelerated approval, the definitive trial has to be ongoing, and you know it's all hinged on that. And here we have a trial that did not meet its pre-specified endpoint. Clearly, at least it was not worse than Pomdex, but certainly was expected to be better, and it didn't meet that. And I think from an FDA standpoint, I think they're looking at, you know, just holding the line, so to speak, I guess.
So to be continued, but let's start making rounds here. We're going to start out with a 71-year-old woman, standard risk myeloma, according to the doctor, quote, borderline transplant eligible. Here's Dr. Morgenstein.
She's currently on daratumumab, bortezomib, and dexamethasone with a plan to start lenalidomide when we can get it. And there's been some issues with access, but we're getting it. And then my question is, we actually face this a lot as far as four-drug regimens in patients who are transplant questionable. And I use that term because, you know, when we first meet somebody, we see a lot of patients who are in their 70s. Their performance status often isn't good. You know, this question of transplant eligible is somewhat difficult. This woman technically would be transplant eligible. Should we use a daratumumab-based regimen, RVD, and how much should we use a daratumumab upfront? Should everybody be getting it? Second question is an old question, is what is the optimal bone-directed therapy, zoledronic acid or denosumab? And then what's the best advanced imaging? Are we moving away from skeletal surveys? Is everybody getting PET scans? Can exazimib be substituted at some point for bortezomib in patients with transportation issues or just patient convenience? Myeloma has become quite confusing again. Is transplant still the standard of care, even though we found out that, you know, delaying transplant might not be detrimental? And then the last question is, are we curing myeloma?
I think myeloma has always been confusing continuously, but, you know, basic questions. What's first-line therapy myeloma? You think that would be a pretty straightforward question at this point, but not really. Yeah. Any thoughts about the many questions he has?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously, if you think about someone whom you are definitive about going, you know, taking the stem cell transplant, the VRD remains a standard of care. In our own practice, we have been using the daratumumab combination, the quadruplet regimens, only for patients with high-risk disease. The reason why we have not, you know, jumped into the quadruplet bandwagon for everyone is primarily because of lack of definitive data. Now, the Griffin trial shows that there is an improved PFS, no difference in overall survival, certainly has disadvantages because only had 100 patients in each arm, and a third of the patients in the VRD arm actually did not end up getting maintenance. So that makes it a little bit hard to interpret the data and be definitive about it. We know for sure those patients are getting really, you know, just taking that quadruplet arm in isolation, we know we are seeing MRD negativity rates that are much higher than what we have historically seen with VRD. And understanding that for high-risk patients, getting to MRD negativity is probably one of the most important aspects of or goals of therapy. So getting them to MRD negativity is important. And so for those patients, I think, you know, using whatever we can to enhance the likelihood of them getting to MRD negativity is important. So we feel more comfortable using it. Now, one of the arguments is that the Cassiopeia trial used Dara VTD and showed it was better than VTD for BFS and overall survival. But we can't really extrapolate that data because VRD is so much more effective than Dara RVD, than VTD. And so what is the incremental advantage or benefit of adding Dara to an effective regimen like VRD needs to be proven in larger phase 3 trials. And the data is right around the corner. We should be seeing the data from Perseus trial here in the next year or so. So it's quite possible, you know, a year from now, we'll be sitting here and saying everybody needs to get a quadruplet. But until we have that, I think we still need to maybe limit to VRD for the standard risk patients. Now, the question of transplant eligibility, I think we struggle with it all the time, right? I think a lot of the phase 3 trials have shown that 65 and below clearly benefits from transplant. The 65 to 75 have been up in the air a little bit, primarily because a lot of the transplant trials did not include them. There have been retrospective series, both from CIB, MTR, and single institution studies, demonstrating that selected patients between 65 and 75 do benefit from transplant. Having said that, there was data present at ASH this year showing that if you do 140 milligram per meter square melphalan conditioning versus continued lenalidomide dexamethasone, they didn't seem to be having an advantage for that reduced dose melphalan transplant in patients over 65. Now, I think it's still something that we'll continue to debate, but I think patients who are in good functional status can certainly be taken through transplant safely, and they seem to benefit. So I think it's a discussion, an individualized discussion for those people between 65 and 75. Another important point with the eligibility is that a lot of patients, especially this patient with poor functional status related to myeloma, could improve and look like a very different person after a couple of cycles of effective therapy and myeloma being controlled. So to me, the transplant eligibility is not a one-time determination. It's an ongoing question that needs to keep addressing during that first few cycles of treatment. And then you know, coming to the end of that fourth cycle or 4 to 6 cycle, we can make that decision. Do we go to transplant? Do we just collect and store? Or is it somebody whom we think will never really get to transplant and we just forget about that and move on?
So before we explore a little bit more about those issues, any comments on choice of bone-directed therapy, the use of exazimib in the upfront situation, particularly like this patient had a lot of transportation issues, and also imaging in myeloma?
Yeah, so the imaging in myeloma, clearly, I think the whole body low-dose CT scan has become the imaging modality of choice. It's certainly more sensitive compared to traditional X-rays. We identify at least 25% more patients using whole body low-dose CT scan compared to just regular X-rays. In terms of the bone strengthening agents, I think our go-to agent still continues to be bisphosphonates or zoledronic acid. Denosumab certainly can be considered. They are quite equivalent in terms of their bone-directed efficacy. But we tend to use denosumab primarily for people with renal insufficiency or renal problems, because I think those people certainly seems to do better with denosumab compared to zoledronic acid. But from a pharmacoeconomics perspective, it makes more sense for us to continue to use zoledronic acid. Now, finally, the whole thing with exazimib is a little bit more confusing, certainly not straightforward. I know during the 3 years of pandemic, we certainly changed a lot of patients on bortezomib maintenance to exazimib to avoid that trip to the clinic. You know, there's no head-to-head comparison bortezomib versus exazimib. We know that the newly diagnosed trial looking at IRD versus RD failed to reach the primary endpoint in terms of the improvement in PFS. But we also have data from the phase three setting in the relapse myeloma that IRD is an effective triplet regimen. So I think if somebody is on some form of continuous bortezomib-based therapy and they don't want to come to the clinic, I think it's reasonable to consider using exazimib. Certainly need to watch closely those patients for side effects and so forth.
So here's a paper you wrote earlier this year before the determination data was presented, but you told me that it really didn't change anything. And this is an algorithm you have. I notice on the right, transplant period, maybe you want to comment on that to start with, but in terms of the determination trial.
Absolutely. So I think you know, the high-risk patients certainly need to be approached differently. And I think if anything, we, you know, it's one very, very important lesson we have learned over the past few years. So why do they need to be treated differently? Primarily because, not because they don't get to a deep response, but partly because their responses don't last long enough. So I think it's very important for us to get those people into a much deeper response and even, you know, even at the cost of slightly more toxicity compared to the standard risk patients. So I think that's the reason why we would like to use the four-drug combination. But the determination trial also showed, consistent with what has been seen in the past, that use of an early autologous stem cell transplant actually helped the high-risk patients, you know, relatively or proportionally much more than the standard risk patient. So I think if somebody has a high risk myeloma, I would definitely take them to an early transplant. The question that comes up is, do we do a tandem auto transplant as consolidation? I think the European trials did demonstrate a benefit for tandem transplant, but they were all in the context of, you know, less optimal induction therapy like VCD compared to the Dara-VRd we are using nowadays. So we already know from the Griffin trial, if you use Dara-VRd and a single transplant, you are still getting, you know, a significant, you know, 70 to 80% of these patients to be MRD negative or closer. So that leaves a, you know, relatively smaller proportion of patients who really need additional intensification of therapy. And I think majority of those patients can get to the point where we need them to be at by using the two-drug maintenance that we often give these patients until disease progression. But if somebody is, you know, not quite there and is in good shape, young patient, I'd certainly have that discussion regarding tandem transplant with those patients.
So I'm going to ask you about the left side of the graphic here, the standard risk, and you have both options of collecting cells and going ahead with the transplant, or just hold on to the cells, do four more cycles of VRd, and then len maintenance. But, you know, when I talk to investigators, I kind of get the feeling that they generally favor transplant, even in the standard risk situation. And I guess my question is why? You know, transplant is not an easy experience for somebody. So my question is, A, do you think there really is a survival benefit and maybe the trial didn't pick it up? Do you think quality of life is better? I mean, why would you go through this experience if it really is the same outcome?
Yeah, no, I think it's an important question, but I think the progression-free survival is significantly better, right? So I think the French trial, the IFN 2009 trial clearly demonstrated an improved progression-free survival, you know, a little over 12 months. And now the determination trial also shows a PFS improvement of almost 20 months. So clearly, I think the fact that you can be on maintenance therapy, just one oral drug, and not have to worry about more intense therapies for a much longer period of time, because what awaits a patient who relapses after transplant is a triplet, like a DRD or DKD or DPD or any of those combinations. So if you can push that 2 years out or 20 months out compared to, you know, people who are not getting transplant, I think it is a modality that we should pursue, and it's an outcome that we would like to have for our patients, especially the younger patients who often are still working and would like to continue to do that and getting them good quality of life. Now, there's certainly a short-term deterioration of quality of life as people are going through transplant. As you said, it's not a very, you know, easy process to go through, but that quickly comes back to baseline. And so there's clearly not a long-term quality of life impact. If anything, I think in the long run, it's improved by just being on a singular drug for a long period of time, and often without a drug, because some patients go off maintenance after 3 years.
So, you know, our way of doing consensus and guidelines is we just ask a bunch of people what they do, and if they all do the same thing, we call it a consensus, but if not, right, then it's maybe more controversy. You were saying that your group, you know, sticks with triplet RVD in a standard risk situation, but yet when we ask the rest of the faculty, everybody else says quadruplet, you know, just a, you know, interesting variation there. You explain your rationale. Owen in the chat room wants to know whether or not adding in Dara impacts stem cell mobilization.
It does affect stem cell mobilization to some extent. What we have seen uniformly is that there is some reduction. This has been shown by the French in their IFM trial. And, you know, but the impact isn't that much that it would preclude transplant. If you're thinking about collecting for two transplants, it could be more of a problem. compared to just a singular transplant.
So let's go on to another case, and we were talking about high risk, and here's a high-risk case. Actually, a patient who's on a trial, the dramatic trial. 53-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Narayan. Here's the case.
53, presented with bilateral hip pain, had x-rays that showed multiple lytic lesions in the femurs and pelvis, and had anemia with a hemoglobin of 10 grams, significant acute kidney injury compared to her baseline creatinine with a creatinine of 3.5 at presentation, as well as hypercalcemia. And she's young, and so we did refer her for an auto stem cell transplant. But should an upfront autologous stem cell transplant be considered in all eligible patients with 1Q21 is the second question. And finally, you know, what would be the choice of post-stem cell transplant maintenance therapy among high-risk patients? Would the investigators choose a proteasome inhibitor or just use standard of care lenalidomide maintenance?
What's the patient's current situation?
So she had induction with VRD, then had an autologous stem cell transplant, and then post-transplant, she enrolled in the dramatic trial. She got randomized to the daratumumab plus lenalidomide maintenance arm. She actually had an MRD analysis as well at the one-year mark for the trial purpose, and she has no evidence of minimal residual disease, doing really well on maintenance in the trial.
So I just want to recommend to the audience, we try not to cover all the slides, but we put a lot of stuff in the slide set for you to check out. Really, you should check out this paper on risk stratified management that you did with your colleagues. I love these boxes that sort of summarize everything. I'm not even going to go through it, but it's just very practical. I guess one thing that, you know, comes up here is, you know, kind of sometimes it seems like everything gets put into a high risk category without any shading. So, I mean, I kind of have the feeling that 17P is worse than the others, but can you give us a little bit of qualitative interpretation in terms of high risk?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think typically when we talk about high risk, we are thinking more in terms of the cytogenetic high risk. So it's clearly the 414, 1416, 17P deletion. 1Q remains a little bit controversial, but amplification 1Q definitely is a high risk. In our own hands, again, 1Q also tends to have a higher risk or poorer outcomes. And what we have seen as with the determination study, as well as some of the European data, is patients with high-risk myeloma certainly seems to benefit from getting in that early autologous stem cell transplant and being on that two-drug maintenance therapy. Because the key thing is, you know, these patients do get to a deep response, but keeping them there takes more than just one drug. And I think that's the lesson that we have learned over the years. Now, obviously, there are other characteristics that also are important from a risk standpoint. So ISS stage 3 high LDH still has independent prognostic value. So both the revised Mayo risk stratification system, as well as the R2 ISS or the second version of the RISS, has given more of that quantitative aspect to this risk scoring system. So each of those high-risk characteristics, whether it be a high-risk translocation, 17P, 1Q abnormality, LDH, or an ISS stage 3, they all seem to carry a relatively similar hazard or risk, so to speak, that is cumulative in fashion. So you can essentially, you know, the more the number of these things you have, the worse that patient is going to do. And that has kind of led to that more of that use of that double hit and triple hit type of myeloma. And there was data that was presented at ASH from the UK group confirming that cumulative impact or cumulative risk that we see with multiple abnormalities.
What about the issue of DARA as maintenance with LEN? It's a dramatic study that the patient's on is comparing actually those two. But for now, how do you approach the use of DARA in maintenance, you know, in patients who get quadruplets? Do you use it? Do you use it for 2 years? Do you use it indefinitely? What do you do?
Yeah, so the places where we ignore on practice, right, the quadruplets are mostly used in the setting of high-risk patients. And those patients, what we have learned is that a proteasome inhibitor and immunomodulatory drug combination is probably the best. Maybe the daratumumab and lenalidomide combination might be equally good. We just don't have the data to say that. Because especially when you look at the Cassiopeia data, people who got daratumumab in maintenance or didn't get it in the maintenance, but when you look at the subgroup who got it as part of induction therapy, it was unclear if continuing on the DARA as part of maintenance added a lot more to what was achieved through the induction therapy. So given that those two kind of sets of data, our approach right now is to use the proteasome inhibitor, bortezomib predominantly, and lenalidomide as maintenance until disease progression. But this particular patient that we talked about, I think this patient is doing great on daratumumab and lenalidomide, is MRD negative, which is what we would like to get to for this high-risk patient, so certainly a good outcome.
So, and of course, you know, oncologists love the idea of maintenance daratumumab compared to lenalidomide, which, of course, has a lot of challenges. And that also leads into the question of sub-Q anti-CD38, where you've done a lot of work. There was more data presented at ASH. We know that investigators have completely switched over to sub-Q. Pretty much almost all oncologists in practice have as well. But I am curious about sub-Q sub-Q ESA. There was some data presented at ASH on that, and they have a device that they put on similar to what I guess is used with growth factors. Any experience with that? And do you, of course, that's a tremendous advantage to a patient. Do you see sub-Q ESA coming into practice?
Yeah, I certainly think it's going to be an important aspect of that particular drug. You know, we have seen that, as you just showed, daratumumab has universally become subcutaneous in terms of route of administration. The on-body device, which is what the isatuximab is taking, or the route that they are taking. And I think it's going to definitely make it convenient for the patients to use the isatuximab and kind of put it on a level playing field with what we are seeing with daratumumab.
So very common question from my college. I think Dr. Morgenstein brought this up, and lots of people bring this up, which is your patient's been on lenalidomide a long time, they're getting tired of it, they have side effects. If they're MRD negative, do you feel better? Would you stop it? And actually, most of the faculty say no, except you and Dr. Fonseca say yes. So what situations do you think about doing that? I assume people are having problems with lenalidomide.
Right. So I think the key, you know, I don't necessarily do MRD testing on all patients on lenalidomide maintenance. The place where I end up doing it is if somebody is having a lot of side effects, you know, they already had the 2 or 3 years of lenalidomide maintenance, and this is really a quality of life issue, and we are trying to kind of look at the pros and cons and make a decision. At that time, I feel the MRD testing can be of value. If somebody is MRD negative, I think I would be lean more towards discontinuing and, you know, trying to focus on that quality of life. Maybe if somebody is still positive, maybe we'll try and continue for some more time. And there was some interesting data that was presented at ASH looking at the duration of maintenance, looking at some analysis from the UK trial, the Myeloma 11 trial. And, you know, again, a little bit of this is modeling and so forth. And they feel that at least, you know, the patients continue to get benefit for up to 3, maybe even 4 years of maintenance therapy. But beyond that, maybe it is questionable.
So, you know, we just came back from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting, which is a couple of days before ASH, as it is every year. And we did an entire symposium on HER2-positive breast cancer, which is only 20% of breast cancer, but so much to talk about. I'm kind of wondering if these next two cases that we're talking about, people with T1114 myeloma, maybe someday we'll do separate, you know, programs just on T1114. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But anyhow, here are two cases for your thoughts.
He had a translocation 1114, and he was treated upfront with standard of care VRD and autologous stem cell transplant. Patient stayed in VGPR for about 2 years, but then the patient had recurrence of disease, still expressing 1114 translocation, but also he developed renal failure from disease. Would you consider venetoclax in this patient, and in which combination? I end up giving this patient venetoclax, bortezomib, and dex, and the patient has actually responded. In a patient with myeloma 1114 translocation, when do you introduce venetoclax to these patients? What's the rule for giving venetoclax in combination as a frontline setting? I think that would be interesting, looking into venetoclax for induction, you know, frontline.
The patient then underwent a bone marrow biopsy, which demonstrated 30% cap-restricted clonal plasma cells, and a myeloma FISH panel was noted for a translocation 1114. And she did undergo advanced imaging, and a PET CT did not show any FDG avid myelin bone lesions or lytic lesions. And so, you know, the main question with this patient is, you know, what is the preferred approach and the management of this patient with smoldering myeloma? I'm not familiar with the use of venetoclax, particularly in smoldering multiple myeloma. You know, that's certainly a very important drug, I think, in the translocation 1114 patients, and this patient does have a translocation 1114.
And you presented data on the management of high-risk smoldering disease at ASH. Any comments about these two scenarios? And I guess I think the reason she brought up the renal failure, you know, oncologists are used to being worried about renal functioning with the venetoclax from CLL, where they see a lot of TLS. This patient did fine with venetoclax. And it doesn't seem like it's that much of a problem with myeloma. Anyhow, any thoughts about first, you know, where, how to use it today with myeloma, and maybe in the future, do you see potentially being incorporated into therapy of smoldering, and any updates on treatment of high-risk smoldering?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's clearly, you know, a drug of great interest in the disease. Now, I think myeloma, as we all know, is very heterogeneous, and, you know, we have some primary genetic abnormalities, the translocations in about half of them, and hyperdiploidy or trisomies in the other half. 1114 is about 20% of patients with myeloma. And they, you know, biologically, it seems to be quite a distinct subgroup. They have more B-cell-like features. They're high expressors of BCL2 in their cells. They generally tend to be small plasma cells. Clinically, they often have high levels of light chain and hence more likely to present with renal dysfunction as well. Now, I think in that first scenario of a patient with relapsed myeloma, you know, venetoclax is certainly a legitimate consideration, considering, you know, again, in the context of the 1114 abnormality. The question is, where exactly do we use it, right? So what we don't have at this point is large phase 3 trials demonstrating the value of venetoclax over standard of care therapies. The Bellini trial looked at patients with venetoclax added in combination with bortezomib, but the entire trial only had 35 patients. So it's a relatively small subgroup that had translocation 1114. So in that context, you know, my own personal preference is to use it more in the later lines of therapy. So if somebody with 1114 translocation first relapse, I often still go to some of those triplets where we have, you know, pretty solid data from the phase 3 setting. And beyond that, especially once they have seen a anti-CD38 PI and an IMID, that's when I really want to use the venetoclax. And typically I tend to use the venetoclax in combinations. I don't use the bortezomib combination as much because people have often seen that quite a bit of bortezomib by the time they get there. So I tend to use more the carfilzomib or the daratumumab combination. Both are combinations that have been studied in the phase 1-2 trials that have been published. So so that is, you know, certainly we can use that. We also want to look at, you know, in these patients, ensure that there's adequate infection prophylaxis, because one of the signals we did see in the Bellini trial was increased risk of infection. So until we have data in the phase 3 setting to say otherwise, the default should be to use infectious disease prophylaxis. Now, hopefully, you know, the CANOVA trial will read out later sometime, soon in the next year or so, that will tell us, you know, the activity of venetoclax plus dexamethasone, and hopefully make it available for patients with myeloma. Now, the smoldering becomes a little bit more of a challenge. You know, I think given that we are all just using venetoclax in the relapse setting, I certainly would not consider using that in the smoldering myeloma. Of course, you know, the smoldering myeloma, the concept is one where we don't treat everybody. We're just going to be treating the patients who have high-risk smoldering based on the 20-to-20 criteria. And those patients, we know from two phase 3 trials now that treating them with lenalidomide or Len-Dex can improve not only the time to progression to myeloma, but also the overall survival, suggesting early intervention is kind of bending that arc and changing the natural history of this disease. Now, venetoclax, while it's quite attractive for somebody with 1114 smoldering, still should be studied only in the context of a clinical trial. And finally, I think the question of using venetoclax as part of the injection therapy, so that is something that is being actively pursued in clinical trials right now. I think it makes great sense to explore that. can we, you know, add venetoclax to a PI plus IMiD combination or a monoclonal antibody plus IMiD combination? And that may be the quadruplet of choice for somebody with 11-14 myeloma, in which case we might continue on maintenance therapy in those patients with venetoclax for a period of time. And that could really make a significant impact. And we need to do the clinical trials necessary to prove that. Now, just looking at high-risk smoldering myeloma, I think there's a lot of interesting data. There are phase 3 trials ongoing asking the question, should we be treating them with this small, you know, less intense therapy like lenalidomide alone, or should we be treating them like myeloma? And the other important question is, you know, given that we have this precursor stage that often lasts for several years, can we intervene with therapies that could potentially eradicate the clone and maybe even cure some of these patients? So that was the kind of the goal or the hypothesis behind the ASCENT trial that I presented at ASH this year, where we took about 87 patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma and treated them for a defined duration of 2 years with a combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, daratumumab, and dexamethasone, so DARA-KRD, for a year, and then maintenance with just daratumumab and lenalidomide for another year. And what we saw was that, you know, nearly 64% of these patients were able to get to a VGPR, or get to a CR or better. And we also saw that almost 2/3 of the patients were able to get to a minimal residual disease negative state. And this coupled with the data that was presented from the Spanish GEM-CSER trial, also demonstrating very similar results without the monoclonal antibody, but with incorporation of transplant, you know, again, highlights that maybe we are going to be curing some of these patients. But clearly, that's going to take a while for us to read out.
So here's the way the faculty uses venetoclax most, including you, as you were saying, use it second line. Dr. Fonseca seems a little bit more ambitious. Everybody uses it in combination. And this is a phase 3 study that I think you were commenting on, looking at this in the relapse setting. So I want to go on to another case from the real world and ask you for a real-world answer about what to do. 77-year-old man who is getting a DARA-RD but has a very bad rash.
This is an elderly patient, very routine DARA-RD in the first-line treatment. So he had rash from DARA, and it just got out of control. It was unbearable, uncontrollable, unable to overcome no matter what. So we actually have to abort DARA for this patient. So my question for the expert panel, is there any prophylactic methods, or do they see this severity of DARA-related rash often? How much mileage we get just from a lenalidomide dexamethasone regimen? He's doing pretty well right now. Things seem to be well controlled.
So have you seen this? Yeah. And any point in considering isatoximab?
You know, it's very, very uncommon to see rash related to daratumumab. Most of the time, the skin reactions that we see, which is, you know, almost 15% of the patients can get skin reactions to lenalidomide, which often responds to discontinuation. And majority of the patients, you restart them at 15 milligrams instead of the 25. They just seems to do fine. So again, I think the key thing is to try and make sure that this is not related to lenalidomide and in fact maybe related to daratumumab. So if it is indeed related to daratumumab in a patient like this who is in good functional status, who can tolerate a triplet, I would add bortezomib to the lenalidomide dexamethasone. On the other hand, this is more related to lenalidomide and the dose modifications have not helped and patient is still having a rash, then I would definitely replace a lenalidomide by adding bortezomib to that daratumumab combination. So either DVD or VRD, depending upon which drug this patient is allergic to. But, you know, if for somebody who's able to tolerate a triplet, then a triplet should be used. But certainly if, you know, if the patient cannot tolerate the three-drug combination, I think Lendex is probably the treatment of choice based on data from the phase 3 trials.
Any reason to think isatoximab would be any different?
You know, I think it's worthwhile exploring. I don't know if it'll be feasible given that we don't really have an approval for that in the upfront setting. But, you know, I think it's worthwhile considering that if we do end up proving that this is daratumumab related.
So any comments on the standard approach to older patients like this one? You know, DARA-RD seems to really have captured everybody's attention. although I've been starting to hear people talking about bringing in proteasome inhibitor on top of that. And Dr. Richardson, there's an RVD light consideration. Any comments on your typical approach to 80-year-olds?
Yeah. So I'm not sure how I answered the data VD, but it should be data RD. That's a typo.
Yeah, that's a typo. Sorry.
Right. So I think the Meyer trial, you know, shows clearly really good efficacy. In fact, we presented updated analysis at this ASH meeting with almost 64-month follow-up and showing that the progression-free survival, the median PFS, is actually a little over 5 years. And you know, that's not a PFS that we have typically seen in this older patient population. We often think about that for the young, fit patient going through transplant and maintenance. So I think that is a remarkable result. We also see that the overall survival is significantly better. Now, with almost a 74-month follow-up, the 5-year overall survival is almost 68% in the patients with newly diagnosed myeloma. So I think, you know, if you're going to be using a triplet, I think Dara-Lendex would be my first choice. Clearly, if there are situations where we cannot access Dara or issues with daratumumab, I think VRD is reasonable, or as the case we just talked about, even DVD. But I think daratumumab has really made a difference to these transplant-ineligible patients getting upfront therapy.
So here's another case, getting into the question of the day, which is, what do you do with quad-refractory patients? And people get quad-refractory pretty quickly nowadays if you use it upfront. This is an 84-year-old man, as often the case, multi-regimen refractory. I spoke with Dr. Bacow a couple days before teclistamab was approved, but he already knew it was coming. Here's his question.
84-year-old man with a history of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer and IgA lambda multiple myeloma, who I've been seeing for a while. The question I have for the experts are, what factors favor a switch in therapy in a patient with relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma that has biochemical progression only, but no other evidence of end organ damage? And then how many bispecific antibodies are under development or approved for relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma? How is one going to choose between a bispecific product or CAR T-cell therapy for the treatment of relapsed refractory multiple myeloma? And what are the rates of ICANS and cytokine release syndrome with the bispecific teclistamab? Are they low enough that somebody like me in the community will be able to give this medication eventually? Teclistamab is going to be approved relatively shortly from what I understand. And I'm going to have to send them to somewhere to get it, unfortunately. My hope is something like this, these bispecifics will have such low rates of cytokine release syndrome and the ICANS and the neurotoxicity that I can give it in my office, in my community hospital. Someday. One of my questions here, it's like, how would you sequence them?
So I'm sure you only hear these questions like 5 times a day nowadays, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think before we jump into the bispecific aspect, I think an important question that was brought up was, you know, what time do we start treatment for patients with relapsed myeloma? I think it all depends on the underlying biology of the disease. So I think if you have a patient who has been rapidly cycling through multiple lines of therapy, quickly becoming refractory, that is a patient whom I would probably start even new therapy, even with biochemical progression. On the other hand, if you have somebody who gets 4 or 5 years with each regimen and then they slowly relapse and you move on to the next one, don't have any high-risk characteristics, that is somebody who I might watch to get a good sense of what is the trend in the disease parameters before I jump into therapy. Now, I think for someone who is multi-agent refractory, particularly the triple-class refractory patients, I think the bispecific antibodies certainly offers a new option, an exciting new option. And these are patients, you know, by label, which should have had 4 prior lines of therapy. And for these patients, you know, the bispecific antibodies across the board seem to be giving responses in the 60 to 70% range. And, you know, there are several bispecific antibodies in development. Majority of them are targeted towards BCMA, but we also have talquetamab that is targeted towards GPRC5D. We have cevostamab that's going after a different one called FCRH5. So clearly multiple targets that can be looked at using this bispecific antibody platform. Now, in terms of toxicity, we do see a cytokine release syndrome in nearly 60% of these patients across most of the bispecifics, maybe lower for some. But the good thing compared to CAR T is that most of these tend to be grade 1, maybe a few of them grade 2, and easily manageable with the use of drugs like tocilizumab. Now, you know, they do bring up an important question as to how do we actually utilize or make sure the bispecific antibodies benefit patients out in the community. And I think there's still a lot that needs to be learned in terms of how we can prophylax or decrease the risk of cytokine release syndrome. There was data presented at ASH looking at prophylactic tocilizumab administration that seemed to significantly reduce the risk of cytokine release syndrome, almost go from 70 to maybe 35%. Now, that, there are other approaches, particularly step dosing approaches that are being explored. But hopefully over the next year, as more of these things come to market and with increased experience, we can come settle down on a few measures, prophylactic measures that will reduce the risk of cytokine release syndrome to a low enough level that these patients can get started on therapy out in the community. Now, thankfully, the ICANS or the neurotoxicity is significantly lower with bispecifics compared to what we actually see with the CAR Ts. And so it becomes less of an issue. And I think certainly, you know, we need to keep keep an eye out for that potential toxicity in these patients. And I think it's a steep learning curve. I think as we end up learning more and more about their management, we will be able to get these in the community and everybody should be able to administer these drugs, even if it means getting the first cycle in a in referral institution.
So, like your reaction to you and your colleagues' view of immunotherapy in myeloma, we say, when looking at the two approved products, do you see any difference in efficacy? And, of course, indirectly, it looks like the response rate is greater with cilta-cel. And most people say that. We asked about tolerability. Most people say about the same, although you thought itacaptagene. You know, there's this Parkinson's thing that was seen with cilta-cel that I don't know that's been seen with ide-cel. In terms of when you would like to use CAR-T, interestingly, at first relapse, very different than the current situation in terms of approval. And of course, everybody acknowledges the fact that just getting any kind of CAR-T is positive because it's very difficult to get a hold of. Any thoughts about these issues?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think in terms of, you know, we don't have any trials directly comparing them, but numerically, you know, not only is the response rates and the MRD rates seem to be higher with cilta-cel, but also the durability of response, the, you know, the median PFS that we have seen on the cilta-cel trials, certainly more than the what we have seen on the ide-cel. Now, having said that, I think they all need to be paraphrased in the sense these are not direct head-to-head comparisons. You know, when you look at the toxicity profile, we certainly did see the neurotoxicity that you just mentioned, which seems to be better controlled once we start using, you know, better bridging therapy and better disease control going into the CAR T administration. So I think there's maybe in our own practice to, you know, we tend to use the ide-cel maybe in patients who have less likely to tolerate some of the side effects that we have seen, and maybe use the cilta-cel more in the more fit patients. But again, in a lot of these choices are comes down to what is available. I think we all tend to use whatever we can get our hands on for the patient who needs a CAR-T.
So as always, we put a bunch of slides in the slide deck for you to check out with papers on bispecifics and CAR-T. There's a non-BCMA bispecific that has a FDA breakthrough designation, talquetamab. We'll see where that lands. Final topic, selinexor. And, you know, when I ask community-based oncologists about selinexor, they usually, a lot of times they'll say, I tried it once, the patient did really well, I never want to use it again. And then when I go to investigators, I hear a different story. So I want to show you a little video. First is a general medical oncologist as who kind of answered my question kind of the way I mentioned. And the other was from about an hour ago when I was working with Dr. McHale in another program. I mentioned we're doing this thing in January. And I asked him how he uses selinexor and to ask you whether you agree with his perception. So here's Dr. Narayan and Dr. McHale. Any questions about selinexor?
I have used selinexor. I just struggle with a lot of toxicity with this agent. And so I'm always a little gun shy with selinexor. So, you know, do they do an upfront dose reduction with selinexor? How the experts manage that?
I have the privilege of having used selinexor, in fact, in hundreds of patients. And like every other drug in myeloma, we don't use it now the exact way it first came out. Every drug goes through its evolution. And in my pragmatic practice, when I use selinexor, I think the major two shifts we have seen is, number one, that it's used weekly. Number two, that it's used at lower dose. And in fact, maybe even number three, that we give it with very particular supportive care. So I use selinexor all the time. I always use it weekly now. I typically even start at a lower dose than what was in the clinical trial in combination with bortezomib, which was 100 milligrams. I would say the majority of my patients start at either 60 or 80 milligrams weekly. And I make that decision based on their underlying frailty and their cytopenias going into it. Selinexor now can be partnered with multiple drugs. Although the trial was done with bortezomib, now with NCCN guidelines listed, we use it with carfilzomib, which is pretty much my favorite partner, especially in higher risk disease. But we can also use it with pomalidomide and with daratumumab. Lastly, the supportive care is fundamental. And I simplify it by saying this. First of all, you must give two anti-nauseants to patients prophylactically. You don't wait until they experience nausea. So I give a 5-HT3 antagonist, something like ondansetron, along with olanzapine, which I find helps with the, if you will, mental nausea that patients can get with this. The first month is the worst month. I've really found that patients, once they get through that more difficult first month, then it becomes a lot easier. And with time, we might be able to taper down those anti-nauseants. So weekly, lower dose, appropriate anti-emetic therapy, which is a dual therapy, and particularly close monitoring in that first month has been my recipe of success in using selinexor. How about you, Shaji?
Yeah, I think I completely agree. I think the key thing is making sure the patients are aware of the toxicities, making sure they have enough medications to take care of the nausea that can come with this, making sure they're staying hydrated and using antidiarrheals to ensure that they don't get into problems with that. And I think key thing is also to start at a lower dose and kind of explore individual patients' ability to tolerate the drug and then go up as needed. And I always use it in combination, almost never use it by itself.
And curious, he was saying his favorite current combination is with carfilzomib. It looks like the faculty, everybody uses a PI, but a little bit split. Any thoughts about choice of PI?
Yeah, I think carfilzomib is a good combination. The data looks really good. And by the time the patients get to this point, they are often refractory to bortezomib or cannot take it because of neuropathy. But also, daratumumab is also a good drug for it to be combined with. So I often go with whatever they have not seen for a while. So if they have not seen a PI in a while, I will use carfilzomib. If they have not seen a CD30, anti-CD38 in a while, I will use the daratumumab.
So as I flip through some of the slides and papers for the group to consider, one final question from the chat room from Dr. McKenna. This is a simple one. Should CAR-T come before bispecifics or vice versa? Just kidding, not simple at all.
No, don't simple.
Let's say theoretically, right, if you can get both.
I think there's some data that's coming out now, I think, in the sense, there's data suggesting that the activity of the CAR-T after bispecific and the activity of bispecific after CAR-T both are lower than what one would anticipate otherwise. So the question is then, which one do you use first? And to me, pharmacoeconomics-wise, they are pretty much a wash because of the way the pricing is for the bispecific that needs to be given continuously for a period of time. So then the question is, for CAR-T is a lot more appealing to the patient because it's a once and done. You give the CAR-T, and you are, you get good quality of life without ongoing therapy. So to me, if you can get a CAR-T, that would be my first choice. Of course, if there are issues in terms of whether the functional status or their comorbidities that prevent somebody from getting a CAR-T, certainly the bispecific expands the ability for a larger group of patients, older, more frail patients, to also get immunotherapy. So in those patients, I would definitely go to bispecific first. But I think the biggest challenge we have is that the vast majority of the patients are not going to be able to access a CAR-T, and I think bispecifics provide a really good option for those patients.
Where do you see bispecifics landing like in the next year or two? Do you think it could potentially be second line?
I certainly think it could be the second or third line therapy in the next few years. I think the phase 3 trials are already ongoing. So it's a matter of waiting for those to read out. And it may not be, it's quite possible that 5 years from now, we'll have bispecifics as part of their upfront therapy of newly diagnosed myeloma, of course, in combination and hopefully given for a defined period of time.
Any thoughts about these non-BCMA bispecifics in terms of tolerability and side effects compared to BCMA?
Yeah, and so we have probably the most robust data with talquetamab, and I think it's almost as effective as the teclistamab based on the data that's been presented. There are some unique aspects to it. There's skin and nail toxicity that you can see with talquetamab, which is again because of the expression in those tissues. We do see some dysgeusia or altered taste in these patients, which, you know, all of these things together can have some impact on the quality of life. So obviously we need to obviously wait and see what larger studies bring forth. The FCHR5, the cevostamab, again, I think, some unique toxicity aspects to that, but certainly response-wise, they all seem to be quite comparable. And I think the key thing is, again, you know, making sure the patients understand the toxicities they are facing with these kind of therapies, so they are, you know, they're prepared for it.
So one final question from the chat room. What do you think is going to come first, BCMA or non-BCMA in terms of sequencing bispecifics?
I think the BCMA is probably going to get used first, just because, you know, that's where the data is coming alone as well as in combination. So I suspect that's going to probably take a earlier position, so to speak. Then the question becomes, can we use the bispecifics again? And I think it's quite possible we may not use them back to back, but it's possible that we may use a bispecific based combination early and then use some of those PI, anti-CD38, IMiD triplets in the next line, and then kind of go back to another bispecific with a different target.
So, Saji, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Thank you for attending all year. Coming back at the beginning of the year, we're going to talk about what happened in breast cancer 2022 with Drs. O'Shaughnessy and Schmidt. Be safe, stay well, and have a great holiday season. Thanks so much, Saji.
Thank you.